copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
I was brought up in Scotland. My father went to plant a church at a time when church planting meant three things. It meant you built a building, you provided a minister or a priest, and you had a program. That was it. And because most people in that culture at that time thought of themselves as Christian, the only issue was what church were they going to join. So if you had a great program and a great minister and a great building, they might join your church. Then in the mid-60s we moved to England and we discovered that it was a completely different situation. People were not thinking of joining churches. In fact, it was probably about the last thing on their mind. And we were living in already a post-Christian context and a post-Christian culture. And we soon discovered that planting a church in that context was completely different. Now, I then trained for the ministry in my early 20s, and I went to a church. My first church was inner city Birmingham. Here was a situation which I'd never come across before. It was a church that had been in decline for 50 years. In fact, the elder of the church took me round the neighborhood and he said, "I joined this church in 1930 and it's been in decline ever since." Now, I don't think he was making a connection between his joining the church and the later decline. But can you imagine how depressing? You join a church full of hope and enthusiasm and expectation, and then every year for 50 years, the church declines. Terrible, terrible experience. But I also realized that in coming to this church, I really had no idea what to do. How do you go about changing a situation where the church has been in decline for so long, especially in an inner city area, and especially when the people who did attend the church did not live in the neighborhood? They came in from other areas to try and keep this small struggling church alive, and they had no connection with anybody that lived in the neighborhood. So that was a fascinating issue. Now, actually, the church did grow, and we started to plant churches from that location. And it was only later that I realized that actually what we were doing in church planting was really just a different form of what we'd done to revitalize the church in the inner city. And really, I would have been much better to have done church planting first, and then to have... I did it in the wrong order. But still, I learned some of the same lessons. So, we're going to explore that over the next hour, so we'll see how that goes. So the first thing I want to say is the key issue, whether you're church planting or whether you're revitalizing a church, the key issue, I'm sure you understand, is the issue of leadership. Now, what do we mean by leadership? So I want to ask you the question, first of all, and maybe you could turn to your neighbor and begin to discuss this for a minute. You could, if you don't have an immediate neighbor, you could have groups of three. But turn to your neighbor and ask the question, can everybody lead? Are leaders born? Are they something that just is a unique gift that you just can't introduce? Or is everybody a leader? Can you train everybody, educate everybody to be a leader? What do you think about that? Could you turn to your neighbor for a moment? Is everyone a leader? Some of you were quite animated and obviously in disagreement. Nobody actually hit each other, so that was good. But I could see some of you came to a view quite quickly, and so the discussion was less animated. But let's just hear a few views from around the room. So what was the answer in this area at the back here? What were you saying to each other?
So our group seemed to focus on the leader building to show that they care for you.
Okay.
Or relate to you. So
okay.
Relate to you when you can relate to them.
All right. So you chose not to answer the question, actually. You chose a different question, which is absolutely fine. And do you know what I find? I find that leaders often do that. That they often answer a different question than the one you asked, and that's absolutely fine. It's also what happens with referenda, I notice, that when you hold... I think it was François Mitterrand who said, the problem with referenda is that people always answer a different question than the one you ask them. Slightly what happened in Britain with Brexit, but we won't go into that. Yeah, absolutely. Ah, okay. But the question was, is everyone a leader? But that's fine. You picked up an aspect of leadership, and that's really helpful. And the implication of that is that if everybody could learn how to care for each other, in your definition, then quite a lot of people could be leaders, couldn't they? Is that a fair interpretation of what you're saying? Maybe? What do you think?
It's one aspect of leadership.
Okay, one aspect of leadership. That's good. Over at the back, this side. Okay, so you're taking the view that leadership is a particular kind of gifting. Okay, so it can develop. It doesn't come fully formed. As you're born, it needs some work in order to... You're born with a gift, but then it needs to develop after that. Okay, over here, what were you discussing over here? So it's an indication of a leader. Are people following?
Yes.
Yep. Okay. Okay. So another kind of complexity, it's also can be situational. Your style of leadership can be affected by the context in which you find yourself. Yep. Okay, over here. So you're making a distinction between primary leaders and, if you like, secondary leaders. Yeah, okay. Just as this group asked a supplementary question, you have too. And actually, that's quite an important insight into the nature of the question. So, yeah, what do you mean by leadership exactly? That's a really good question. Over here.
Everybody can cook. But not everybody is a chef in a restaurant.
Okay, that's a really good analogy, isn't it? Okay, so I think what we've seen from this very brief discussion is that actually this is quite complicated. For example, probably everybody could lead in something. That doesn't make them necessarily the primary leader of a church, for example, but maybe everybody could lead in something. We could also see that some people could be potentially leaders but would need some help developing their leadership. We can also see that somebody who's a really great leader in one context might actually be quite a poor leader in another context. So actually this is a fairly complicated subject. But it's important that we get to the heart of some of the issues here, because actually revitalization does depend crucially on leadership and leadership styles. So let's just think about this for a moment. Certainly Jesus has quite a bit to say about how we engage our leadership, how we use leadership. You remember the discussion that he had with his disciples, where their mothers, the mothers of the of his disciples, wanted to know, what about the position of my boys? You know, good Jewish mother. What's the future for my boys? Are they going to be on the right hand and the left hand? What's the future? And Jesus had something very important to say, didn't he? He said, you know that amongst the Gentiles and the Jewish leaders, some lord it over others. And that very crucial little phrase, not so among you. Not so among you. Powerful words. Setting a completely different style about the nature of leadership. And then just a short few days later, he emphasized that point because he washed their feet. Shocking, shocking thing to do. Because that was not just the task of somebody who was not a leader. It wasn't even the task of a servant. It was the task of the lowest of the servants. I mean, it's an amazing thing to do. And it was deeply connected with the point he was already trying to make about leadership. So I think what we could conclude from many of the things that we see in the New Testament is that leadership is usually plural. That is to say, it's usually shared. Secondly, leadership is about serving others. And thirdly, nearly everybody could lead in something, but some are called to a kind of primary leadership role. Now, one of the ways in which we can think about that primary leadership role is to turn to the Ephesians 4 passage. And you'll know that in that passage you have talk of four kinds of leadership gifting, ministries. Now, what has happened to the church, particularly in Europe, is that over time we've tended to concentrate on two of those giftings. We've tended to concentrate, well, what would you suggest? What giftings out of those five? Pastors and? Well, I would say, I would argue teachers actually, that amongst local church leadership, that's been the most valued quality, pastors and teachers. Now, it's not an accident that that has happened. It's because we went through a period of time where Europe was largely Christian. Now, when a situation is largely Christian, what do you need in a situation like that? You need people to care for those who are Christians, pastors, and you need those who are going to teach those who are Christians to be better Christians, teachers. And so the primary gifting that was valued because of the context was pastors and teachers. Now, what also happened, at least in those countries where there was a lot of theological education, those who were going to be selected for leadership were chosen on the basis that they might be good pastors and teachers. And so you have a system developing where You're trained to be better pastors and teachers, but you're also selected because you have that potential gift. And so what happens is that we arrive at a situation where actually that is the only way in which we understand leadership. Are you a pastor? Are you a teacher? Preferably, are you a pastor teacher? So the question arises, did God stop creating apostles, prophets, and evangelists?
Very good.
Okay, well, I'm going to give you my answer. I don't think he did. But the question is, what then happened to these people? What did the church do with people who became apostles and prophets and evangelists? What did the church do with them? What any ideas? What do you think happened to people with these kinds of giftings?
In Europe.
In Europe, yeah. What do you think we did with them? What do you think we did with them? Yeah, go and plant a church somewhere else. So some of them went as missionaries overseas. Some of them went into the business world, used their gifts there. Do you know, I have talked to many, many business people in Europe who said to me, I felt a call to the ministry. And I offered myself for ministry. And my denomination, my church, said no. And I've never been able to understand why. These are people who have been successful in the business world. You can see they're very good leaders. But actually, you can see that the reason the church said no was because they had these kinds of giftings. They were good communicators, they were good leaders, and they had very often an insight into what the situation required, what we might call a prophetic gift. And that was very uncomfortable for the church systems of which they were a part. So that's what often happens to these people. But here's the problem. In Europe today, we need such people to help revitalize the church. We need those giftings in leadership if we're going to be able to revitalize the church. Why do we need those giftings? Well, first of all, because these are the giftings that help us to see a situation afresh. When I went to my first church in the inner city in Birmingham, what I heard all the time was, these are the things that have worked in the past, and we don't know what else to do. It was impossible for them to look at the situation through fresh eyes. And what they elected to do was to bring somebody into the situation that could start to see things through different eyes. What's the first question that somebody needs to ask that's trying to look at things through different eyes? What do we see God doing in this neighborhood? What do we see God doing? What is God up to that we can cooperate with? It's very difficult to see what God is up to if you've become so familiar with the situation that actually you become temporarily blind. You can't see God's activity because you're so used to the situation. So we need the apostolic gift. Now, what do I mean by the apostolic gift? My simple definition of the apostolic gift is the apostle is somebody who has the capacity to start new things. It's not really more complicated than that. It could be a new ministry. It could be a new evangelistic initiative. It could be a new church plant. It could be a new anything. But basically, they have the capacity to see things differently, to see what God is up to, and to start new things. In fact, the apostolic type cannot help starting new things. It's part of who they are. Wherever you find these people, whether it's in the business world or whether it's in the church world, wherever you find them, they just can't help it. They start new things. It seems to just flow out of their very personality. And you need these kinds of people. And often that means bringing in leaders from outside, because usually churches which are in need of revitalization do not have such people in their midst. Now the problem is, where are you going to find such people? And it may be that you can't employ somebody or bring somebody in on a permanent full-time basis. It may be that you have to borrow somebody. It may be that you have to bring somebody in as a short-term activity. It may be that a group of churches, if you like, could share somebody. But somehow or another, it's very important in revitalization to find, to access that apostolic gift. You might not need them the whole time, but you need them to provoke new thinking. So that's my first question. Where are you going to find an apostolic type person that can help the church with new thinking, to see afresh? Almost certainly it's going to be leadership from outside, and that's part of the difficulty of revitalizing, because usually actually leadership from outside is actually viewed with suspicion. It's a big risk to bring in a leader from outside, and not every church is willing to do that. Usually a church that needs revitalizing has become that way because they haven't had such a person. Usually. There could be an exception, but usually it's the absence of such people that has brought the problem in the first place. Sometimes we have got these people, but we're not willing to allow them to lead, for the reasons I've just indicated, that they're deeply threatening. And usually then we force them into, why don't you become a missionary? China, that sounds like a good idea. Anywhere, Antarctica, evangelize the penguins, anywhere, as long as it's not here. These are people that disturb us, aren't they? They're unsettling. But yeah, so part of the willingness of the church is to say, do you know what, we're going to have to adapt new leaders. Now, what happens when an apostolic type person comes into the situation is that they need to go through a process of renewing the existing leadership. Now, renewing existing leadership can mean one of two things. It can mean, let me help you with some new thinking, let me help you with some new skills, let me develop your leadership. Or it could mean, it's time to stand down and bring in some new leaders. There are some other potential leaders in the congregation that we have overlooked. Could mean both of those things. But actually, unless you renew leadership as a priority, you're going to struggle to revitalize the congregation. So that becomes an urgent priority. Now, within all of this, and we probably haven't got time to develop this point, but let's just mention that there are many leadership styles. There are many leadership styles. And it's important to understand the culture of a particular congregation to understand which leadership styles are going to work and which leadership styles are not going to work. So there's a range of leadership styles, ranging from I am the leader and you do what you're told, through to I am the leader and I'm going to consult with you. And there's a lot of shades in between. Directive leadership is still leadership. Consultative leadership is still leadership. So it's very important that we don't just impose any style, but actually we adopt a style that's going to work in a given culture. As you know, Europeans in the West, Western Europeans, are much more likely to execute leaders who appear to be too domineering as compared with, for example, an African style where they look for a strong leader. So there's various different styles, and none of these styles is either right or wrong. They are appropriate for the particular culture that we face. Okay, so in conclusion with this slide, we're simply saying the first issue in revitalization is the issue of leadership. As we've seen from our quick discussion, it's not a simple issue, but it does revolve around where are we going, how are we going to broaden the leadership style in this church. The church has probably got some good pastors and teachers, but how are we going to bring something fresh that's going to allow the congregation to see with new eyes? Anything you want to raise from that before we move to the next slide? Okay. I made a statement a few moments ago which you could challenge. And I'm going to invite you to challenge it now. So I said leadership is always more than one. Leadership is always team. Now, some people don't think that's true, but that was the statement I made. So turn to your groups again, and just for a few minutes. What do you think of that statement? Leadership is always more than one. Is that true? Leadership is always more than one. That's my statement, but you might disagree with that. Take a moment to talk about that.
A leader who is not followed by anyone is just taking a walk.
Okay. Well, there's an interesting comment. Okay, over here. Yep. Even God is a team. We need each other. Okay, so accountability is part of it. Yep. So this is all about the higher the level, the more team you need. That's a very interesting point. So anybody not contributed? Yes, over here. Okay, are you suggesting that different ages of leaders have got different styles around whether they produce team, or what are you concluding? So the point that's being made is, from research, at least in the United States, was that churches which are revitalized tend to have older leaders, i.e. over 40, whereas church planters tend to be under 40. Interesting. You need a first amongst equals, but they need a team to be part of. Okay, great. Prophetic and evangelistic gifting. Yes, I think that those are also very important to bring into the context of leadership. Now, again, it may be that these giftings, especially in a smaller church, just aren't present, and you need to maybe bring them in for a period of time, partly to help lead that area, but partly also to lead by example and to stimulate such giftings that actually might exist in the congregation but are not yet developed. Because sometimes you need to see a gift in action to understand what it is. So my definition of prophetic and evangelistic would simply be: the prophet is one who's able to sense what God is doing in a given situation, and the evangelist is the one who's able to communicate well, whether personally or in some other way, the core message of the gospel. So again, we can all bear witness, can't we? But some people seem to have the unique gift of being able to communicate the message, especially to those who are outside of the life of the church. Okay, so let's just think about we're talking about team, and we're talking about, well, what does team look like? And again, there's not a lot of time to develop this, but what I would want to say is that it takes time to develop a good quality team. There's no shortcut. It just takes time. And one of the issues that comes up as you spend time with each other developing trust and relationships one with another, is the issue of values. Now, let me explain what I mean by that. Very often when I'm working with churches as an external consultant, I'll often check with them, so what's the purpose of this church? Why are you here? That's the first question. Why are you here? What are you trying to accomplish? What would that look like in, let's say, the next 3 years? How would you express your purpose? What's your vision of what the church is going to look like? What are your values? And I'll come back to that in a second. And out of that, what goals are you going to set for the next 6 months, and what plans are you going to make to accomplish those goals? So that's a kind of very basic framework for leading a church through revitalization. But actually, it's this area that's the most important and the most difficult to understand. Because what you'll often find in churches that are in conflict, or churches that are having difficulty getting unity in the team, is that they might well agree on this. Yeah, we agree on our purpose, we agree on our vision, we agree on our goals, we agree on our plans, but we still got disunity. And it's often because there's a clash of values. So what do we mean by values? You can get at somebody's value by asking the question, what really matters to me about this church is? Okay, this is not to do with thinking, it's to do with the gut. What really matters to me? What do I feel passionately about? So, I went to a church once that had grown very quickly. It had grown from 35 to 350 quite quickly. And they called me in because they were stuck. They had a big conflict. They had a big leadership team, 15 people in the leadership team. So I had the leadership team in the room and I asked them this question. Finish the sentence that begins, what really matters to me about this church is. Finish the sentence for me. And do you know, I got 15 different answers. What really matters to me about this church is the youth. What really matters to me about this church is the worship. What really matters to me about this church is commitment to the poor. What really matters to me about this church is overseas mission. Oh, it was amazing. None of these answers were bad. They were just different. And because they didn't understand the values that each of them had, whenever it came to deciding priorities, how are we going to spend our money, what are we going to do, where are we going to focus our attention, there was always a tension and a conflict. So we need to be able to negotiate our values. Actually, we can embrace lots of different values, but we need to understand what they are. So they need to be out on the table. What's really driving your people? What are they really passionate about? It's quite an important part of building the team. So in other words, what we're really saying is that team is vital in revitalization, just as leadership is vital. Team is vital, but building the team takes a lot of time. You're trying to build relationships. You're trying to build trust. And that means doing much more than just business together. What's the best way of building relationships in a team? Well, anyone at all, what would you say? If you're going to build relationships in a team, now here's a Frenchman just indicating something.
We are saying we are reading books together.
You're reading books together? Okay, well,
it's more or less the same.
Okay. You're reading books and he's drinking wine. Okay, all right.
Action together on weekend. Yeah. Nature, adventure.
Okay, there's lots of ways of doing it, aren't there? But it all involves spending time. For me, see, in our culture, my particular church, it's always to do with food. When we eat together, we behave differently with each other. We might have some wine as well. But something happens, doesn't it, around table, around that kind of fellowship, whether it's in the wild or whether it's in suburban England, something happens. But you can see the point. It's going to take time, and it's frustrating for some people because they say, we want to get on with the task. Never mind all this eating together and reading books together and going in the wild together. What about the task? Okay, but actually, you'll get to the task far better if you've got a team with strong relationships that understand each other and trust each other. We need to press on, so I'm going to ask you another question now. So we're talking about church planting techniques. So church planting always begins with leadership. It then tries to build a team. And the third thing it then does is it asks the question, the number of churches that are seeking to be revitalized, who answer the question in exactly that way, we're trying to reach everyone. Which means they reach nobody, yeah.
Try to reach your...
All right, so you have a particular target group for your style of church, young families. Okay, it's a very good answer. All right, well, now that's fascinating because what we see very often in churches is an inability to be able to figure out, well, just who are we trying to reach? And the discipline of church planters is that actually they're very good at being able to say, let's look at a given neighborhood and let's begin to identify who lives in this neighborhood, who do we have the best chance of reaching, and why would we reach that particular group? Because obviously eventually we want to reach as many people as we possibly can, but actually we don't necessarily start with everybody. We might begin by prioritizing a particular group. And the discipline that church planting begins with is the ability to analyze an area. Who lives here? Who do we have the best chance of reaching? What do we observe in this neighborhood that really is an opening? Who are the people of peace, for example? What are the needs we see in this neighborhood that we might be able to begin addressing? That's one of the disciplines that church planting brings, and which those churches in need of a revitalization need to learn. How do we see our neighborhood, and how do we begin to prioritize those that we might have the best chance of reaching? Okay, now another related question church planters also bring to the discussion is how do those who don't come to this church see us? Now just take a minute. If you were to think about your own local church, and just imagine what would happen if you went out into your neighborhood and ask the question, would you come with me to church and just tell me what you see?
She said, I liked your church that no one was staring at
me. Okay, all right. So that's one response. Okay. She felt accepted, so that was good. Anyone else? The location of the church isn't very helpful. That would be one reaction. What about the actual event itself? What would they say? Strange. This, yeah, it's very unfamiliar to me. Okay, anyone else? Okay, so the building is an attractive feature for people in your particular neighborhood. Anyone else? They don't understand what's going on here. Okay, all right. So the point about church planters is that they start with the question, what would it feel like for those coming into public worship for the first time? How do we rethink what we're doing so that those who are coming in for the first time feel, okay, the basics are being done well. They get a good welcome. at least three or four people speak to them before they leave the service. That actually they get the sense that this is a place where prayer is taken seriously. That actually there's a word of explanation about, well, what's actually happening now? When do we sit down? When do we stand up? What's going on? And suddenly, you know, a signal happens and suddenly everybody's doing something. Well, I don't know what I'm doing. What's going on around me? So that's another piece of discipline that church planters bring. They have the ability to think about the worship service, the experience of those who are coming for the first time, from the point of view of the outsider, not from the point of view of the insider. When I was a student pastor, I went to a church and I gave them a questionnaire and I said, how do you see yourself? And I had, I think, about 10 questions. And the first question was, would you say you were a friendly church? And they scored themselves very high, 10 out of 10. We are the friendliest church on the planet. Do you know what my experience was as an outsider coming in? At the end of the service, everybody just spoke to each other. My wife and I were left standing speaking to nobody. Of course, they scored themselves very high on friendly because they were very friendly with each other. But there was no welcome to anybody else. So they had to learn how to see themselves from the point of view of the outsider. So last discipline from the church planters, and it's what I call changing the conversation. So if I were to ask you the question, thinking about your local church and thinking about the neighborhood, what kind of conversation goes on between your church and the neighborhood? What kind of conversation goes on? Anyone at all? What kind of conversation do you think happens between your church and the neighborhood? Suspicion. What are you doing here? What goes on in that place? What are they trying to do here? Are they trying to trick us? Are they trying to cheat us of money? Yeah, okay, so suspicion. Okay, that's the conversation you'd like to have. We are not a cult. Yeah, okay. Do you know, most churches which are in a revitalization process, the only conversation they have with their community is something like this. They ask of their community the question, why don't you come to our church? Now, that's not much of a conversation, is it? So the issue is, and this is what church planters are very good at, they're very good at generating or changing the conversation. So let me give you an illustration of this. The church I'm presently a member of, about 2 or 3 years after we started, we realized that actually most people in the neighborhood had no idea that we were even in existence. We met in a community center, we were a little bit invisible. We were actually operating the community center, but we were still quite invisible. So we conducted a survey in the neighborhood and we asked the question, what do you think are the greatest needs in this neighborhood? And the top three that came back, it would be different in your neighborhood, but the top three that came back in our neighborhood was, one, there is no children's playground in this neighborhood. Wow, we had not noticed that. Two, there's nothing for young people to do. Three, there's nowhere for us to meet our friends for conversation. Wow, interesting. And so the first thing we did was we mobilized the community in raising funds to build a children's playground because we had some space next to the building. And we built a children's playground with the community's money. Actually, all we did was we provided the space and mobilized their help. That immediately changed the conversation with the neighborhood. Wow, you did this. This is amazing. Why would a church do this? You didn't do it for yourselves. You did it for the community. That's amazing. And the second thing we did, we also had space to open a cafe next to the playground for mothers to meet their friends and also watch their children. That changed the conversation again. And then we also provided some youth work based on the building. So actually what had gone from a situation where nobody knew we existed and there was no conversation began to be a really interesting conversation between our church and the community. So how do you change the conversation with your community? And key in that is to find the people of peace. Now I'm sure you've explored the people of peace before. Is that a familiar term? Yeah, a lot of you have explored that, so I won't say anything about that. But developing a conversation and then out of that conversation beginning to build a strategy for growth out of awareness of needs, that's a really key way of beginning to see the church grow again. So these are some simple insights, if you like, from church planting disciplines. So just to recap, number one, leadership, it matters. Number two, building team is crucial. Number three, understanding how others in the neighborhood see the church. Number four, knowing who we're going to try and reach. And number five, how do we change the conversation we're having with the neighborhood? These are the insights that church planting can bring to the revitalization of existing churches.